Well, this is a Friday, which means it's a forensic Friday, and Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson back from a well-deserved vacation, all refreshed and all that stuff. You liked it. You liked Italy, huh?
I did.
I've always heard it's just a fun place to go. Fun
well,
people.
It's, boy, it's old.
Whew. Old.
Yeah. The it was a lot of fun, and good. My wife and I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah.
And glad to be back, though.
Well, good to have you back. Mr. Laren did a great job in your absence, as he always does.
He does. Dan's a star.
He is a star. He told me that last week.
Yeah. Well, he told me that.
We've too. Got a star as a guest this morning, too.
Rob Sanders is the Commonwealth Attorney in Northern Kentucky, in Kenton County. And he really has turned into a star amongst Commonwealth attorneys. He's an excellent prosecutor, runs a great office, and they always have interesting cases. And so that's the reason he's on so often, is because some of the cases are interesting. By the way, Rob, welcome.
Thank you, Ray, and happy belated Boss's Day to you. I know you're not technically my boss, but definitely somebody that I've modeled my office after, so I appreciate those compliments. It's very flattering coming from you.
How about that?
Yeah, well, Rob, I think, must be running for...
He's running for something.
Attorney General, Governor.
So you enjoyed my tweet this morning, Rob?
Yes, I did. I retweeted that. I thought it was pretty amusing, and, you know, compared to the guy you tweeted about that's counting the bags of crack from somebody's crack, I think I'm having a pretty good day.
Well, you're not kidding. It's if you want to, these guys and gals find the most interesting places to hide their drugs.
Yeah, well, this was a true story. A guy in Connecticut was found with 49 bags of crack in his butt.
Well, for his sake, I hope they were small bags.
I hope so. But anyway, so we got an interesting case this morning that involves a bunch of people.
Well, let me tell you something. Everything I talk about goes back to my whining about this House Bill 463, the legislature's experiment, catch and release experiment for people who commit crime and caught. House Bill 463 came up with this language called the preferred sentence is supervision in the community. That means they're probated, or you get to ride down the elevator with the person that burglarized your house because they're put back on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
They're property crimes, and property crimes have just skyrocketed with this House Bill 463. Now, property crimes, they steal property, break into houses, break into cars, steal cars, all that sort of thing. But they have to get rid of the stuff somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're talking about today. We're talking about the places people take stolen property, and they're called fences. Rob, tell us about this case. This was an organized crime case.
Yeah. It was an organized crime case, Ray. We Covington police sort of stumbled across a store that they were having problems with. They were getting reports that people suspected that they were dealing in stolen goods, and from the outside, this store looked like a pawn shop, which, you know, we run into pawn shops that are sometimes questionable, but more often than not, they're very cooperative with law enforcement because they don't want to get a reputation of being a problem for the community. So the Covington police started investigating what looked like a pawn shop and found out that they did not have an occupational license. So they issued him a citation, and the owner of the pawn shop, a guy named Charlie Wilson, didn't show up for court to answer that citation for not having an occupational license. So the court issued a failure to appear warrant, and a couple detectives, Detective Kane and Detective Ewell, went up to the store to arrest Mr. Wilson on this warrant. When they walked in, they found, wait a second, this isn't a pawn shop at all because there's nothing here in pawn. But there
now,
were
now,
stacks
wait a minute, wait a minute.
Of brand new items.
Hold on.
Still in the wrapper.
Hold on. Now tell us, you say that it wasn't a pawn shop because there was nothing on pawn. Now explain how a pawn shop works.
Well, a legitimate pawn shop is one where if you need money in the short term and you have something of value, maybe it's a piece of jewelry or a gun or a television set or what have you, you can take whatever your item of value is to this pawn shop, and they will give you an amount of money for that item, and they will agree to hold on to your item as collateral for your loan for X number of days. And if you don't come back to buy back your collateral within a certain number of days, whatever the contract is, then they can turn around and sell it for whatever profit they can make on them. And most pawn shops, if you take them a $500 television, they might give you $100 for it. And obviously then, if they bought a $500 television for $100, they can resell it and make quite a bit of profit. And that's really how they make their money, is when people don't come back and buy their items out of pawn.
So what happens then is, they went in there and they didn't see anything for sale.
No, there was nothing for sale at all. All they found were items that this cash-in store was buying. They found literally garbage bags and boxes full of brand new batteries, teeth whitening strips, electric toothbrushes, home pregnancy tests, baby thermometers, fishing reels, SD cards, brand new clothing of all sorts, Bengals jerseys, hunting camouflage clothes, Under Armour gear. They found gift cards for stores where people had stolen stuff and returned it and then sold the gift cards back to this cash-in store. All sorts of items that were brand new.
Cash-in, was that the name of the store?
That was the name of the store, and I guess that meant like cash in your stolen stuff here.
So what did it look like from the outside? Was it just like a plain building, or what did it look like?
No, it was in a strip mall. It was one of maybe a real small strip mall, maybe four or five stores. It had a phone store on one side of it and a pizza parlor farther down and a convenience store on the other side of it. It was just your average run-of-the-mill little strip mall like I know you all have tons of in Lexington. And it had a big sign out front that said cash in, and it looked like a pawn shop. But once you got past the front door, it was quite obvious that there was nothing for sale there, that nobody had come and pawned anything legitimately.
All right, we're going to take a break, and we'll open our phone lines when we come back. If our listeners this morning have a question or a comment for our guest, Rob Sanders, Commonwealth Attorney in Northern Kentucky in Canton County, 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T, toll-free from anywhere. 924, News Talk 590, WVLK, Ray Larson, Commonwealth Attorney from here in Fayette County, and Kenton County Commonwealth Attorney Rob Sanders is with us. Ray?
When you and I talked about this case, the process that I followed was I texted Allison Beck, who is basically puts the show together for us, and told her, and she immediately does researches this thing, came up with these photographs of these people and a description of the case, and sends it to Jack, so Jack knows what we're talking about. But in the description, they found that she had found boxes and bags filled with brand new retail items with price tags still on them, numerous firearms, all of that sort of thing. How did these people, so they buy their offense, which is a term for people that buy stolen property. What were they doing with the stuff?
Well, they were selling it on the internet. They had multiple accounts on eBay and all the different sites that sell, you know, normally are used as like a online yard sale. Well, they were selling all this retail stuff online at a fraction of the cost. So if you go, say, a normal Bengals jersey, you know, authentic Bengals jersey might cost you $70 at the pro shop over at the stadium, but they were probably selling it for $40 online. And the same thing all the way down to the batteries that might cost you $5 in a legitimate store, they were selling for maybe $2 online. So it was all a matter of just undercutting legitimate retail prices and making it cheap for people that were shopping for stuff on the internet. And I gotta tell everybody out there that if you're buying stuff off the internet and it's showing up at your house and it's still in the brand new package and you bought it for 50 cents or less on the dollar, it's stolen. It makes no sense. Nobody goes out and buys boxes of batteries just to turn around and sell them at a loss. So if you're doing that kind of stuff, you're supporting organized crime. You're supporting thieves and God knows what else, given the syndicates that they run are all interconnected somehow.
Were you able, because of the price tags that were on some of those items, to determine where they came from?
Oh, yeah. Dick's Sporting Goods was where they cleaned. I mean, I don't know how Dick's made any money for a couple of years while this was going on, at least not the store that they were hitting up, but they were traveling. And I should be more specific. The people that got prosecuted for this organized crime case, they weren't the ones actually doing the stealing. They had what they called boosters that were, in essence, professional thieves, and they would sometimes just buy whatever the thieves bought them or brought them, but other times they would give the thieves orders and say, hey, we're running low on home pregnancy tests. Go steal me some home pregnancy tests. Or they had one lady in particular who specialized in stealing from Dick's. So she was kind of a bigger girl, and she'd go into Dick's wearing an oversized shirt, and she'd just start stuffing Under Armour clothes up under her sweatshirt and then walk out of the store. And Dick's at the time, I think they may have changed this, but maybe not at the time, they had a policy that their employees did not physically confront shoplifters. And she knew this, so she would just go from one Dick's to the other, to the other, to the other, and steal as much as she could, and then she'd drive straight back to the cash-in store and just sell it back to them. So our detectives busted up this first cash-in store in Covington and shut it down, basically, and come to find out through their investigation of that store and their bank accounts that Charlie Wilson had some friends and relatives running a second location of cash-in in Erlanger, Kentucky, which is just outside of Covington, just a few miles south on I-75, almost to Boone County. But they were running the exact same business in Erlanger as well. They basically had two fence locations.
Was it called cash-in also?
Yes, it was also called cash-in. When this first one got shut down in Covington, for whatever reason, these thieves thought that the reason they got shut down was because they weren't using a program called Leads Online. And Leads Online is something that's become incredibly useful to law enforcement when it comes to dealing with pawn shops. What it is a online service where the pawn shops are required by local law to upload a photograph of whatever it is that they buy in pawn and record who they bought it from, a copy of the person's ID, how much they paid for it, and any serial numbers or any identifying information about what the stuff is. That way, if police start investigating a home burglary, they can get on Leads Online and search and say, okay, did anybody pawn a 2-carat diamond ring? Because that's what was stolen in my burglary. And if somebody did, it'll pop up and say, well, yeah, they pawned it at this store. Well, that's required of every city in Kenton County where somebody runs a legitimate pawn shop. They're required to do that. Cash-in wasn't doing it, but after the Covington store got shut down, they started doing it for the Erlanger store. Well, that just gave the police a roadmap to exactly who all the thieves were, the boosters that were working to supply cash-in with the goods that they were selling online. So the detectives actually started staking out the thieves and following them to stores and watching them go from store to store, stealing, and then going right back to cash-in and selling it. And that's how they built the organized crime case against the cash-in store and everybody that was working there and owning it.
Hey, Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson here, and in his office in northern Kentucky in Kenton County, Commonwealth Attorney Rob Sanders is with us. Ray?
Rob, this one went to trial, didn't it?
Well, this case actually, I know we were talking before about a 5-defendant case. It actually started out as a 26-defendant case.
Wow.
21 people pled guilty to felonies of a variety, theft and receiving stolen property and things like that. And Charlie Wilson himself pled guilty to engaging in organized crime. But 5 defendants did not plead guilty, and they chose to go to trial, which is fine by us. Randy Bird, Janina Bird, William Gotze, and Jessica Burnett were, in essence, a couple of husband-wife teams, although one of them might not have actually been married, but they were two couples that were running the Erlanger cash-in store, and one of their employees, a fellow by the name of Josh Meggerly. They all went to trial. That was a 3-week-long trial.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Unusually long trial for us. And Randy Bird, Janina Bird, William Gotze, and Jessica Burnett were all convicted of engaging in organized crime Mr. Byrd got a 14-year sentence. The rest of them all got 10-year sentences, except for Josh Megerle, and he was, I think the testimony showed basically that he was the cashier. The jury only found him guilty of receiving stolen property over $500, and they gave him 1 year in prison.
You know, when I think about organized crime, I, like everybody else, I think of the mob and the Godfather and all that stuff. What is organized crime as far as the law is concerned?
Basically, organized crime under Kentucky law is any time that you have five or more people that get together and engage in one plan or one, not necessarily a conspiracy, because, you know, number five doesn't have to know what number one is doing. You just have to have a group of at least five or more people that are all engaging in this common plan or goal of accomplishing crime. It can be theft, it can be drug dealing, it can be any number of different crimes, but basically when you get it into a large group, five or more people, that's what Kentucky calls engaging in organized crime. And I know Ray will hit on this for me, because he's a, like me, Ray is a big believer that Kentucky law is deceptive when it comes to what is a nonviolent crime. But engaging in organized crime is a Class B felony. It's punishable by 10 to 20 years in prison, but yet under Kentucky law, it is a nonviolent crime. Now, in this case, we can say, okay, theft related stuff, that sounds nonviolent, but it doesn't matter. It could have been five people out to commit murder, and if they get convicted of engaging in organized crime, no matter what they are doing, it's a nonviolent crime, meaning all of these folks are eligible to be out of prison and after serving only 20% of their sentence.
Well, one of when we talk about organized crime, you know, Jack, our law is, most of our laws, in my opinion, are written and are pretty favorable to the defendants. A lot of states have only three people. It's hard to get five people involved, and when this law was passed, there were a number of prosecutors of us that were pushing for the number to be three. And, well, of course, we were told to take a hike or words.
It's different in each state, I'd say.
It can be, right?
Yeah.
And but this is, and we've prosecuted a number of these things, but the kind of cases can be, for example, if you get a group of people that have decided to come down here from Detroit to sell heroin, then it can fit into that category if you can show that they were
in cahoots, as
yeah,
you say.
That's right. You know, one of the things that we're on the I-75 corridor, and Northern Kentucky is right in the middle of it as it comes across from Cincinnati, and I can always kind of ask Rob what's the latest thing going on up in Covington, crime wise or Cincinnati, because it'll be our way shortly. And the heroin overdoses was a big deal, and that was coming from Detroit, wasn't it, Rob?
Yes, sir. It's coming down from Detroit, right down I-75. And just like you said, Ray, I was telling Ray and every prosecutor south of Ray that it's coming towards them as well. And it's branched off. It's gone down I-71 to Louisville and Jefferson County. Basically, heroin has followed the interstate. And now it's gotten off the interstates. It's headed down the AA highway down to eastern Kentucky and Maysville and places like that. And now it's headed down the Mountain Parkway, which is really a scary concept, because the further east you get in Kentucky, the further and further away folks are from their closest ambulance. It's not like Northern Kentucky or Lexington, where, you know, an ambulance is basically 5 minutes from everybody in your county. Down there, you might be waiting 20, 30 minutes for an ambulance, and by then, it helps too little too late.
What is, one of the guests we've had on this show in the past has been a fellow named Richard Wintory, and he was a drug prosecutor in Tucson, Arizona. And Jack, you'll remember, he was talking to us, and he says, when they bring heroin across the border, the key to it is try to keep it off the interstate highways, because if they get access to the interstate highways, it's over. And it, because then it gets into the bloodstream, which is the interstate highway system. Mm-hmm. So what's going on with heroin in your neck of the woods right now, Rob?
Well, we're finally starting to get some people's attention in the legislature, it sounds like. We had a big press conference up here a day or two ago where Republicans in the Senate are putting forth, again, another omnibus heroin bill. It's been tweaked. I think it's a better bill than it was last time around, although it's taken out some of the more controversial items in it, like the ability to prosecute heroin dealers for homicide, like the federal prosecutors can if their heroin dealing causes an overdose death. That's been pulled from the bill, which I'm sorry to see go, but if it will get all the other aspects of the bill passed, you know, I can live with it. But this bill is going to bring things like additional funding for treatment, although they're calling for it out of the savings from House Bill 463, which I don't know how much savings there actually are in that. But they're also calling for removing the previous reductions in punishment for heroin trafficking that we saw imposed when House Bill 463 took effect. That would take anybody that deals any amount of heroin back to 5 to 10 years in prison. It would remove the 2 gram requirement in order to get them 5 to 10 years. And as Ray will tell you, there's no magic to 2 grams. That's just some number that some legislator pulled out of the air and said this is.
Or as we said earlier in the game, pulled out of somewhere.
Somewhere else.
Yeah.
Somewhere else.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we were on are on live radio, so I didn't want to use
thank
what
you,
we've
Rob.
Discussed in the past.
Thank you, Rob. We sometimes have to kind of calm Ray down, and one time I actually had to push the button over here on him and dump him. But anyway, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back. 253. And we are back. We have a call, and this is a call, Rob, I understand, that relates to a case you're working on or have finished, and I know you won't comment on it if you can't, but this is Tom. Good morning, Tom.
You're working on or have finished, and I know...
Yeah, Tom, turn your radio down, please, sir.
All right.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Am I on?
Yeah, Tom, you're on.
I just want to ask a question to Rob. It's about my brother. Sister. We got a sister in Madrid and was down there and doing some work. And a woman asked him to do some concrete work. And so he wrote a contract out and was trying to agree on amount to do the job, and the woman gave him $500 down, and he wanted $1,200, and she offered him $1,100, and on the other $100, she was offering him sexual favors. Come to find out that that woman is a hooker who runs a hooker business that, did, you know, been in jail a lot, and, before it can get started on a job to do the job, the woman jumped the gun, and the reason he had got started on the job because he hired somebody with some equipment to help him move the dirt, to lay the concrete.
Okay, wait a minute. Before you go on, this is getting kind of convoluted. Does this ring a bell at all with you, Rob?
No, absolutely
okay.
not.
Okay, I'm sorry.
But we
obviously this is something that we can't get into on the air, and you don't remember it or hadn't come to your attention yet, I assume.
It raises a kind of a fact situation that prosecutors run into all the time, and that's people that come by to an offer to do repairs on homes. And then the people give them money, and they don't do the job.
Right. And, or do a terrible job.
Well, but and Rob, you run into this as often probably as I do. But the question is it a criminal case or is it a civil case?
Well, we see that probably weekly. We see cases like this, and not, I don't recognized the case this fellow was describing at all. Certainly, I would never advise anybody to enter into a contract based upon a promise of sexual favors, because that's an unenforceable contract to begin with. But even in legitimate cases aside, it becomes a question of, did the person intend to thieve the money at the time they took the money, or did they intend to do the work, and for whatever reason, they couldn't or they didn't? And oftentimes it comes down to, was there any performance at all, or did the person just take the money and walk away? But I'm sure it's the same for me as it is for Ray, as it is for every other Commonwealth attorney in Kentucky, that we get people being taken by less than scrupulous contractors all the time, and they're only too quick to accept money on the front end, and then all of a sudden you never see them or hear from them again, and they don't return phone calls, or they turn their phone off, and they reopen their business under another name after they've ticked enough people off, and they start it all over again.
The well, and there's nobody that's angrier than the victims of these kind of people when you say, well, we're really sorry, but this is civil. And the fellow that was calling mentioned signed a contract for $1,100 plus all of these fringe benefits. And but if you sign a contract, that immediately starts causing you to think this is civil. And the remedy for somebody not performing a contract is to sue them to perform the contract. And that's civil, not criminal. But, boy, people get angry when you tell them that, because basically these people have stolen money from. And you run into that a lot of times when people are in business and they take money from to do this job and they use it to finish the other job. It's robbing Peter to pay Paul, and then all of a sudden business runs out, and it all comes crashing down, and that's a major issue that we deal with here in town. So,
right. It's inevitable when somebody is using money from their second job to pay for their first job that sooner or later they're going to come across the dry spell, and they're not going to be able to pull that off forever. What really angers victims is when they sign this contract, they give them some money, and then they get the contractor will either tear up their sidewalk or pull a few shingles off their roof, or, you know, partial performance of the contract pretty much negates our ability to prosecute it as a crime. And that'll almost cinch the case right there if they've done anything. Well, the last thing you want them to do is tear up your property and then not fix it. So you get somebody, a victim, that's stuck with a torn-up sidewalk or a half-ripped-off roof, and next thing you know, we got to tell them it's not a crime.
Rob, thanks for being with us this morning. We do appreciate it, sir.
Thank you, Rob. Jack, and thanks, Ray. It's been a pleasure as always.
You're the best.
You what?
He's the best.
Oh, the best, yeah. Stand by. We have an update from ABC. If you're listening to WVLK AM, stay with us for Live with Lee. If you're listening to 101.5 FM, The Coach's Show with Joe B. and Denny. I hope you have a great weekend. I'll be back Monday morning at